Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have one case set for oral argument on the 9 o'clock docket, and then we have one case set for oral argument on the 10:30 docket. So we will hear the 9 o'clock case, then we will leave and go into conference, and then we will come back at 10:30. So if anybody's already here for the 10:30 case, we're not leaving permanently. We'll be back. And those of you who are here for the 9 o'clock case, if you want to hang around and watch the 10:30 case, you're welcome to do so. Otherwise, when we finish, you're free to go about your business. All right. So I understand both sides are ready. Is that right? Okay. Then if you'll call the case, we'll get started. Yeah, come on up. That's fine.
The court will now call ABC Incorporated et al. Versus Michael Coleman Morgan et al. And may it please the court, Mr. Matthew Staten to argue for the appellant and Mr. Bill Cleveland to argue for the appellant.
You go by Matthew or Matt or?
Either way, Your Honor, Matt's fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thanks.
May it please the court, counsel. AZZ plans to address three issues in this appeal, in this oral argument. The objective and uncontroverted evidence that Morgan's breaches of his employment agreements caused AZZ to lose business, requiring reversal under this court's heritage opinion. Second, the erroneous and harmful fiduciary duty charge, which eviscerated Texas common law and precluded AZZ from submitting its fiduciary duty claim to the jury. And third, the conclusive and overwhelming evidence of a breach of fiduciary duty under either the standard given under the court's charge or the correct standard. The jury's $0 award must be reversed and sent back for a new trial in this case. The heritage opinion from this court states that when a jury finds a breach of contract, it cannot deny recovery where there's uncontroverted evidence that the party suffered some loss. Morgan does not challenge that we were injured here in this appeal. Instead, he only argues that he didn't cause the loss. That is simply untrue under this record. Remember, while employed as a manager, a trusted manager, a key employee, Morgan drafted a competing business plan that expressly targeted our 20-year customer, AZZ. He solicited Interstate Steel's CEO to invest in or create a partnership with his competing business. These are all, by the way, these are all either admissions from Morgan or documentary evidence. These aren't conflicting evidence. The CEO reviewed that business plan. There's emails and Morgan's admissions that prove that he revealed a plan for Interstate Steel to prepay for product in exchange for an equity stake in his competing business, and Morgan admitted that the customer referenced in that email was Interstate Steel. That's at three reporters' record 119 and 20. The other side denies that. I urge you to look at that record site. Morgan phoned Interstate Steel pervasively over the period of time before his resignation, and he actually worked on his competing business plan during work hours. 2 weeks after resigning, this secret plan that he had, this secret deal with Interstate Steel, was memorialized by a letter of intent to run 4 million pounds of product. The injury was cemented there. It had occurred while he was an employee and a trusted manager, and the injury was cemented when the letter of intent was signed, because at that point, everyone knows that we're going to lose some or all of the business of that company. AZZ then subsequently lost, excuse me, here.
On the timeline.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did Interstate Steel switch to Sabre before or after the letter of intent?
After, Your Honor. I'll try to be detailed with the timeline. Morgan resigned in September of 2011. He then, in October of 2011, got the letter of intent. We subsequently sent a cease and desist letter and filed a lawsuit which put the brakes on him opening. Later, in November of 2012, this is key, November of 2012 is when we finally lost all of Interstate Steel's business, okay? Invoices and relevant testimony, the only relevant testimony was from our expert and our division, Southern Division's operations manager, who said, we reviewed the invoices, we invoiced Interstate Steel until 2012. He's got an argument that a year passed, That's legally irrelevant, but it's also incorrect under this record. So we're at November of 2012 now, and we've lost Interstate Steel completely. Only after all those events have occurred is there some testimony from Morgan himself that Sabre came in the picture and started doing some work for Interstate Steel. So after we've already lost all the business, after the letter of intent, and after all of Morgan's actions as a key employee, 2 months after we lost the business, this period, this narrow window when Sabre was allegedly running an undefined amount of product, by the way, it's never in the record, there's no invoices, there's nothing that tells us exactly how much. 2 months later, Boyce finally opens. And what happens? Interstate Steel sends all of their work to Boyce. All of it. I mean, it's kind of incredible that they would argue that somehow we didn't suffer a loss here that they caused, when simply a short amount of time happened and all of the things that the secret plan, the letter of intent, it all came to fruition and they got all of the business.
In saying that they switched to Sabre, did they totally stop using AZZ?
AZZ didn't do any more business for Interstate Steel in November of 2012. I don't know that the record puts a fine detail on that, but certainly it's indicated that Sabre was doing work after that date of November 2012 for only 2 months. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I believe so. Thank you.
So your characterization of Sabre is just that they were a stopgap measure.
They were a lily pad. Absolutely,
Galvanizing,
Your Honor.
Opened its doors.
Absolutely. That is our position. There's no question that Morgan testified, albeit probably hearsay, that Sabre was given some business. And it's sort of ironic. He says, I stole the work from Sabre and not AZZ. Well, that's not true. You'd already taken it from AZZ when you got the letter of intent. I mean, that's the fact of the matter. But, yes, we categorize that as a stopgap or a lily pad. Absolutely, Your Honor.
Didn't Interstate continue to do business after the letter of intent with AZC?
They did.
For a year?
They did, because they were waiting on Boyce to open. And at some point after we filed a lawsuit and a cease and desist letter, they decided that they could wait no more. And they just told us, we're not using you anymore. The letter of intent already existed. Of course, we didn't know about it until we had done some discovery and filed our lawsuit. Under those facts.
They argue that the letter of intent was solely to get bank financing. Is that correct?
They do argue that, Your Honor. The letter of intent promises that they would use Cole Morgan's new competing business for 4 million pounds of steel, which is roughly between $500,000 and $1 million from what I understand in the record. But yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Under these facts that I've detailed to you, the Heritage case that this court issued is indistinguishable. Both cases involve jury findings of breach of employment agreements. Both appellate records contain proof of some objective loss, and both warrant a reversal of a jury award of $0. We've touched on the causation issue already, so I'm going to move on to the court's defective fiduciary duty charge. The court's charge in this case on the separate fiduciary duty claim was defective because it omitted any general duties owed by a high-level manager in favor of submitting narrow duties of loyalty. As a manager, this court knows under Kinsbach that Cole Morgan owed broad general fiduciary duties because he was a manager. That's undisputed. Why is it undisputed? Because the court instructed the jury that he was a fiduciary as a matter of law. There's no dispute. There was no jury question about that, and they didn't object to that instruction. So under Kinsbach, managers, officers, and key employees owe broad fiduciary duties. That's still good law today. The common law in the PJC lists those duties. This court is well aware of them. They're a duty of good faith and honesty, a duty of candor and full disclosure, to refrain from self-dealing, put all interests of the company above your own, act with strict integrity, and fair, equitable, and honest dealing. And you know how many of those ended up in the court's charge? Zero. Instead, duties of loyalty that were very narrow were submitted in question five. This is a misstatement of fiduciary duty law and precluded us from even having our claim tried. The claim that we pled, the claim that we proved at trial, was taken away from our hands and put in front of the jury as a narrow duty of loyalty case. Now, why did Judge Cosby do that? Judge Cosby is a good and honorable judge, but he was convinced by the other side, and I'm sure that he was convinced himself, he didn't need the other side's help, that the Johnson case limits the duties of an employee. But this misapplies Johnson's holding for two critical reasons. First, Johnson is factually distinguishable, and on its face, it's limited to the facts before the Supreme Court. Remember, Johnson in 2002 involved a salaried law firm at-will employee, not a key manager, who referred a case to another firm for no financial gain. Johnson held that in those limited circumstances, an associate attorney owes no fiduciary duty to refrain from referring a case to other counsel where he gets nothing in return. And the key of that case, as you all know, because I'm sure you've read it, is it focused on the public policy concerns of encouraging clients to receive the most qualified legal counsel in our system. Johnson on its face, Justice Owen wrote, is limited to the facts at hand. Quote, we do not decide whether there may be a fiduciary duty in other contexts. Despite that language, the court engrafted certain dicta language from Owen's opinion about preparations to compete and limited duties of loyalty and used those in the charge instead of the broad fiduciary duties that we pled and tried in this case.
But aren't there other cases holding that the duties owed by an employee are limited, particularly that they're entitled to compete?
There are cases that hold that certain employees may have the scope of their fiduciary duty limited. That is correct. But none of those cases hold that the broad fiduciary duties are eviscerated. The cases that you're referring to, which we mentioned in our brief, and I think they mentioned a few in theirs, each of those acknowledged the broad fiduciary duties, and in each of those cases, either the opinion discusses that you have to submit the broad fiduciary duties and then the instructions on preparations to compete and how they all interplay. In other words, our point is none of the case law eviscerates the broad duties in favor of what Judge Cosby did here, which is submitting only narrow duties of loyalty and an instruction on preparing to compete. The second reason that Johnson is distinguishable is because it didn't change fiduciary duty law the way I just described. Johnson didn't overrule Kinzbach. It never expressly says that it's altering the law of fiduciary duty. Morgan asked this court to construe Johnson and be the first one in Texas to say that it's okay to eviscerate these broad fiduciary duties in favor of a duty of loyalty or preparation to compete language. And none of the post-Johnson cases support this. As I just explained to Justice Gardner, all the post-Johnson cases we've cited in our briefing actually state the contrary, that you either have to submit the broad duties along with those other instructions or submit the broad duties alone. I want to touch on harm before I run out of time because I think the harm analysis is very important here. The Drews case, which was decided by this very panel, says charge error is considered harmful if it relates to a critical, contested issue. Charge error is harmful unless this court is reasonably certain that the jury was not significantly influenced by this error. The other side doesn't dispute this was a hotly disputed case. You can see that we got a breach of contract finding and then we got a no answer on breach of fiduciary duty, which tends to suggest that this was a hard-fought case and hotly contested. AZZ here was deprived of its right to get a finding on the fiduciary duty claim that it pled and tried, which meant we were precluded from getting any damages assessed by the jury which would have related to the fiduciary duty conduct. And we were precluded from getting possible equitable disgorgement of profits, which we pled. Morgan counters, citing a Corpus Christi Court of Appeals case from the 80s, that the $0 award renders the $0 award for the breach of contract claim renders harmless the error on the fiduciary duty claim. Of course, that's inapposite because, first of all, the Corpus Christi court was looking at an unconditional damage submission, which is very rare, I think. I was confused when I read the case why anybody would allow that to happen, but they submitted, it's pretty interesting, they submitted the theories of liability and then three damage questions, and the jury answered the damage questions regardless of what it answered to the theories of liability. And so the court shrugged its shoulders and said, well, they're not going to award any damages, so it really doesn't matter what we do. That's not the case here. Remember, we had a conditional finding, a conditional damage finding which related only to the theories of liability that they answered yes on. So they were only considering the conduct in the breach of contract claim when they put zero in the blank for the damages. I'll admit to you that the damage theory is the same. It's lost profits. But we were also pleading and seeking disgorgement and other equitable remedies. And so we were entitled to not only have our fiduciary duty claim tried, but we were entitled to the damage relief, the actual damages, and the disgorgement theory that we pled. So there's no way you can correlate their harmless error analysis with the case before you. And by the way, we challenged the sufficiency of the $0 award. That was the first point in our brief. We think that'll be reversed, which will show you that there's no harm.
No harm?
I'm sorry. We'll show you that it's harmful error. Thank you for correcting me, Your Honor.
No, I'm just confused.
That's absolutely correct. I misspoke. In my last time, I want to touch briefly on Morgan's own testimony that conclusively proves he breached fiduciary duty under either the standard that was given to the jury or the standard that should have been given to the jury. No reasonable jury could have concluded, and I have a lot of respect for jury verdicts, but no reasonable jury could have concluded that he didn't breach his fiduciary duties here. Remember, he conceded at trial and in his brief that he offered Interstate Steel the opportunity to invest or partner with him in his competing business. He admitted working on his business plan during business hours. He admitted that his written business plan targeted Interstate Steel. He admitted that there was an email in existence that referenced a plan for Interstate Steel to prepay for product in exchange for an equity stake in his company. Those are unquestionably breaches of loyalty, breaches of the duty of loyalty that were submitted, and they are unquestionably breaches of the fiduciary duty. I don't have anything further. If I will yield my minimal time back to the court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Joe?
Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel, my name is Joe Cleveland. I represent the appellees in this case. The utterly decisive point, the point I'd like to address first with the court, is the fact that the jury, there was sufficient evidence to support the jury's zero damage finding for two reasons. First, Morgan's breach of contract was not directly traceable to any alleged profits AZZ lost, and that AZZ's damage evidence was completely incompetent at trial. In this appeal, AZZ is attacking the legal sufficiency of an adverse answer, AZZ, for which AZZ had the burden of proof. And therefore, AZZ must surmount two hurdles in this case. First, the record must be examined for any evidence supporting the jury's finding while ignoring contrary evidence. And second, if there is no evidence supporting the jury's finding, the court then considers the entire record to see if the contrary position is established as a matter of law. AZZ cannot overcome either hurdle. First, AZZ's alleged profits from the potential sale to Interstate Steel are not directly traceable to the breach and did not result from it. And just to trace through the chronology one more time, in 2011, AZZ had a business relationship with Interstate Steel. On September 16, 2011, Morgan terminated his employment with AZZ. Sometime in 2012, Sabre began doing business with Interstate Steel and switched from AZZ to Sabre. And then in January of that relationship continued from sometime in 2012 to January of 2013, and then in February 2013. Interstate Steel switched from Sabre to Boyce Galvanizing, my client. So AZZ did not lose Interstate Steel to Boyce as a result of Morgan's breach. AZZ had already lost Interstate Steel to Sabre sometime in 2012.
But the letter of intent occurred before, I have it in my notes as IS, but is it
Interstate Steel?
I want to say international. Yeah. Interstate Steel. The letter of intent occurred before they started using Sabre.
That's correct, Your Honor. The letter of intent, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it in the record, but if you look at the letter of intent, as Justice Garner pointed out in her question, it was designed to get financing from a bank. It does not commit Interstate Steel to
any. False?
No, it's not false. It was designed to get a idea from the bank wanted to know whether or not
Interstate Steel was going to use Boyce Galvanizing.
Right.
Was going to send them business, right?
I think the testimony in the record, Your Honor, is the letter intent was designed to let the bank know whether there was an exclusive relationship with Interstate Steel and AZZ. So, because they wanted to know that before they would provide financing. and they wanted to know what volume of a business.
Well, if there's been an exclusive relationship before and there's no longer an exclusive relationship after when Boys Galvanizing opens, isn't that some evidence of lost profits?
No, because the chain is broken because of the relationship with Sabre, that three-month relationship with Sabre. If there was no Sabre, there would be a direct line between the loss of the business and Boys. But because Sabre did business with Interstate Steel for that three-month period, the causal connection or the causal link between the breach and the alleged loss of profits is no longer in existence. But going back to the letter of intent, Boyce Galvanizing not only got the letter of intent from Interstate Steel, they also got letters of intent from other customers, potential customers, so that the bank would know, you know, what business is out there and if this business was a type of business that had exclusive contracts. So that was the purpose of the letter of intent. In fact, the letter of intent, Mr. Morgan told the customers during the letter of intent gathering process, he said, this is not committing you to anything. The letter of intent didn't commit the customers to any volume or price or anything. It was just a design to give to the bank so they'd know whether there was exclusive contracts and, you know, what types of volume that Boyce might be capable of obtaining if they got the financing and if they opened a business. So that letter of intent really the letter of intent, frankly, was entered into, or not even, it was signed after Morgan left AZC. Morgan left in September. The letter of intent were entered into from October of 2012 to October 2011 to February 2012. That was the letter of intent period that he collected these. So the letter of intent does not have any bearing on the traceable line between the breach and the alleged profits AZZ lost, because AZZ had already lost Interstate to Sabre sometime in 2012. In 2013, when Boyce opened for business, Interstate was Sabre's customer. Boyce did not take Interstate's business from AZZ. It took the business from Sabre, because at the time Boyce opened up for business, Sabre said, we will give you the business if you meet Sabre's price. That's what Interstate Steel told Boyce. If Boyce met the price that Sabre was providing Interstate at that time and was able to get the business from Sabre. So the break in the causal link is this Interstate Steel's relationship with Sabre during this interim period, which occurred sometime in 2013. The testimony is a little conflicting on that, because Mr. Penley testified that relationship ended sometime in early 2012. Another witness testified that Interstate Steel was last invoiced sometime in November of 2012. But the fact of the matter is that there was a break in the causal link sometime in 2012 until January of 2013. So AZZ did not establish any causal link between Morgan's breach and AZZ's lost profits. The Heritage case that AZZ relies upon is distinguishable, because in that case, this court found that the causal link was established because defendant's own customers testified that they left the plaintiff for defendant's company. In other words, there was a direct link between the breach of the non-compete agreement and the customers leaving the plaintiff's business to the defendant's company. There was not this interim intervening business that broke the causal link in the Heritage case, unlike here. The second reason the jury's zero damage award is supported by the evidence is because AZZ's damage evidence was completely incompetent. Among other things, AZZ's expert included a three-month period of time in his damage calculation when Interstate Steel was sending its work to Sabre. That three-month period between November 2012 and January 2013, the expert included that three-month period in his damage calculation. So in essence, he was charging my clients for the period of time that neither AZZ was getting the business nor Boyce was getting the business. And I think the jury could reasonably conclude that that would have resulted in a windfall to AZZ and could have totally disregarded his testimony just on that fact alone. There was more than a scintilla evidence to support the jury's zero finding, and AZZ has failed to overcome the first hurdle in this court's review process, which makes the second hurdle unnecessary. As to the breach of fiduciary duty submission that Judge Cosby did, I think everybody agrees that an agency relationship imposes certain fiduciary duties. In this case, it's a principal-agent, employer-employee relationship. But it's not a one-size-fit-all situation. I mean, there are cases that say that the attorney's relationship with their client is the highest fiduciary duty. A trustee-trustor's relationship is on a spectrum of extremely high fiduciary duties, duty of disclosure, duty of accounting, duty of loyalty. Same with the trustee and trustor and executor and executor. So I think at the bottom of that continuum is probably an at-will employee. That is an agency relationship.
But don't you have to draw a distinction between an at-will employee and a manager?
I think the court has to look at all of those facts. I think that's what the Supreme Court said in that recent case of National Plan Administrators versus National Health Insurance, a very recent Texas Supreme Court's case. It's cited in our brief. And the Supreme Court said that the trial court should take all aspects of the employer-employee relationship into account and correctly instruct the jury on the nature and scope of the fiduciary duties that are existing between the parties. And that's precisely what Judge Cosby did in this case. He tailored the jury charge to the relationship of the parties that were existing in this case, and didn't just do a one-size-fit-all, let's impose the fiduciary duty obligations that an attorney and a client has, for example, or executor or trustee. He looked at the facts. And as this court knows, the trial court has great latitude and considerable discretion in submitting explanatory instructions and definitions to the jury. And in this case, if you look at the jury's, if you look at Judge Cosby's charge, and look at what he instructed the jury on, it covers all of the duties that an employee owes an employer. But it also carves out these exceptions that the Supreme Court recognized in the case that we've been discussing. And he mentions in that case that when an employee is preparing to compete, he doesn't have a duty of a duty to disclose everything like a trustee or a lawyer has to disclose to his attorney. He can keep that secret. He doesn't have to disclose to the employee that he's preparing to compete. In fact, there are many cases that suggest that, you know, that employee can go rent a building. They can go partner with some other people and sign on a lease. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because in Texas we have a right to constitutional right to go and work wherever we want to, including lawyers. And if this court's going to say in an employer-employee relationship that partners to a law firm or employees can't go and sign leases and do things to prepare to compete, I think it's going to dramatically change the law in the state of Texas. But in this case, I think Judge Cosby got it exactly right. He submitted a jury charge based on the facts that were alleged in the petition and what was the facts that came out during the trial, and narrowly tailored the court's charge to those facts that were presented.
But doesn't your position basically destroy any common law fiduciary duties owed? Because you're saying that there's no common law duties owed as long as you're an at-will employee.
No, I'm not saying there are no common law duties owed. In fact, Judge Cosby said that Mr. Morgan did owe a fiduciary duty to ACC. We're not disputing that.
But he owed basically no fiduciary duty not to compete, not to take active steps to compete, not to no general duty to disclose plans, can secretly join other employees. So you're saying that for all managers that do not have an employment contract, that all that is okay?
I'm saying that as I understand the case law that exists today, that if an employee is an at-will employee, they have a duty not to disclose confidential information of that employer. That's one of their fiduciary duties. They have a duty not to solicit employees, current employees, to go work for their other another company that they're forming. And they have a duty not to solicit current customers to go do business with. And that was all outlined in Judge Cosby's charge, exactly what those employees were not, what a general employer-employee relationship fiduciary duty would not permit. And so he outlined that in that charge. And if you compare that charge to what the submission that AZZ wanted, I think AZZ's charge, and we mentioned this in the brief, that AZZ's charge, it was one-sided. It was a broad construction of the fiduciary duties to the highest level of fiduciary duties that are owed by trustees and executors, and it did not tailor that those fiduciary duties to those that are imposed by law between employers and employees. A final point I'd like to make, unless there are any other questions on the breach of fiduciary duty charge, is because the jury correctly found that there were no damages, any alleged charge error, any alleged error in the jury's liability findings are immaterial and harmless. The general rule in Texas is where a jury finds zero damages, claimed error in the submission or definitions are immaterial and harmless. Likewise, any claimed errors in the jury's liability findings are harmless.
But how can you allege that when the damages claimed under question five are different in that they were seeking equitable disgorgement?
They may have asked that in the pleadings. They didn't ask that in the jury charge conference. If you look at the jury's the judge's charge, it only requested lost profits. They didn't ask for a disgorgement of Voice Galvanizing's profits. There was only a lost profit. AZZ's lost profits were the only damage submission that was submitted. And so unlike what my opposing counsel was saying in this case, that the general rule is not dependent on an unconditional damage finding. AZZ sought the same measure of damages to all three of its claims. They had a breach of contract claim, a breach of fiduciary duty claim, and a misappropriation of trade secrets claim. All three of those claims were directed to one damage question. What were AZZ's lost profits? And AZZ did not object to the way in which that damage questions was requested to the jury. And the jury's zero damage finding applies to all three of those claims.
Are you still answering the question?
Yes. I'm sorry?
Are you still answering the question?
Oh, I can be interrupted.
No. If you're still answering the question, you can continue, but your time's up if you're talking to us.
I didn't see the light pop off.
Yeah, it was while you were answering the question.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't see it. I'm finished. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor. Unless you have any other questions.
My question was answered. Thank
okay.
You.
Okay.
You.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll try to be very brief in the rebuttal and touch on things that were relevant to counsel's argument. First, disgorgement was pled. You don't need a jury finding for disgorgement. It's an equitable relief that we could have asked the judge after we got a fiduciary duty finding. That takes care of that issue. Directly traceable, his argument about the standard to review the causation, not in the charge, not directly traceable. Look at the charge. It says a natural continuous sequence. You can ignore the case law and the argument on directly traceable. The letter of intent is very clear. It doesn't say it's non-binding. It doesn't reference a bank loan. It says, and this is Mr. Morgan talking to Cato, first name basis, it is my assumption that your company will utilize Boyce Galvanizing. If this is correct, how many pounds of steel would you estimate that Boyce Galvanizing would galvanize for your company annually? Answer, 4 million pounds. Signature, Cato Kaufman, President Interstate Steel, October 2011. The injury occurred in this case when Morgan entered into a secret deal. That deal was memorialized in the letter of intent. Then we lost Interstate Steel's business completely. Only after all those injuries did Sabre enter the picture. There was no break in the causal chain. The expert damages he touched on only relates to the issue of whether we conclusively established lost profits as a matter of law. If you find there was some evidence of an injury, you have to reverse and remand for a new trial under Heritage. And that's the argument I've presented to you today. In our brief, we do allege that we conclusively established $454,000 in lost profits. I'll stand on my briefing on that issue because I didn't argue it in the opening. The employer-employee relationship that he's talked about, that's not the same thing as a key manager. Kinsbach Tool, 80 years ago, told us that. It's never been reversed. Officers, managers, key employees are held to a different standard than an at-will employee. This is not an at-will employee case. Even if he's right that about at-will employees, that's not the case you have in front of you. If there's no questions, I'll give the rest of my time back to the court, and I appreciate your attention.
You have questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted, and you are now free to go about your business. You're welcome to come back at 10:30 if you want to watch another case. But we'll be, I guess, in recess until 10:30.